And now I'm very happy to introduce our next presenter, Dr. Michael Maccabee, who will talk to us about the pursuit of happiness, a part of our national values. Dr. Maccabee is a leadership expert, a psychoanalyst, an anthropologist, and an author. Dr. Maccabee is a globally recognized expert on leadership for over 40 years, has advised global leaders in businesses, governments, unions, universities, and nonprofit organizations in 36 countries. He directed Harvard's program on technology, public policy, and human development at the Kennedy School from 1970 to 1990. He graduated from the Mexico Institute of Psychoanalysis, where he studied with Eric Fromm and with him wrote Social Character in a Mexican Village, a pioneering social science research project. He is author of The Gamesman, The Leader, Sweden at the Edge, Why Work, Narcissistic Leaders, The Leaders We Need, Strategic Intelligence, and many other books. And he is the lead author of Transforming Healthcare Leadership. In appreciation of his work in Sweden, he was made commander of the Royal Order of the Polar Star. He is a fellow of the American Psychological and the American Anthropological Associations and the National Academy of Public Administration. He's been a visiting professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Sciences Po in Paris. He taught leadership at Oxford University's Said School of Business, where he was an associate fellow. The Washington School of Psychiatry presented him a Lifetime Achievement Award. He is a strategic leadership advisor to Nuestros Pequeños Hermanos, an organization with homes for orphaned and abandoned children. Apologies for my bad Spanish. MPH has schools, hospitals, and clinics in 9 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean. Dr. Maccabee.
Well, thank you, Richard, and thank you for organizing this very rich conference in terms of ideas and innovation. The title of my talk is Pursuing Happiness in an Age of Disruption and Disunion. We face the danger today of extreme left and extreme right splitting our society apart. I'm reminded of W.B. Yeats's poem, The Second Coming. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-deadened tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. How can the center be strengthened? One way is for citizens of the center, left and right, to engage and create a productive dialogue based on our common values, such as those expressed in our founding documents interpreted for our time. Need a little water here. In June 1776, Thomas Jefferson was braced for tough editing of the rough draft of the Declaration of Independence. The gauntlet of reviewers included Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, exacting wordsmiths, steeped in history, political theory. As the draft passed through the Continental Congress, other founders pushed through so many changes that Franklin at one point had to console a dejected Jefferson. One key phrase was never touched or even debated, and that was the pursuit of happiness, which Jefferson's draft asserted was a God-given right on a par with life and liberty. To some of the finest minds in America, gathered in Philadelphia, the phrase seemed both natural and essential as a guiding principle for the new nation. But what exactly did the founders mean by the right to pursue happiness? It's not a right to be happy. Some scholars have dismissed the right as a glittering generalization that Jefferson used mainly as a relatively meaningless rhetorical flourish to kick off his draft declaration. But recent scholarship makes clear that for Jefferson and his associates, happiness was something achieved from leading a virtuous and productive life in which government, even the limited government favored by the founders, had a role in safeguarding the conditions for aspiring to that goal, to provide people the means to pursue happiness. Jefferson, Adams, and Franklin ultimately understood that the pursuit of happiness was came from the Greek concept of eudaimonia, the well-being or human flourishing that results from the pursuit of a virtuous or rightly ordered life. Carly Conklin, a University of Missouri law professor, has written extensively about this in book and articles. Conklin sees that the pursuit of happiness, as understood in the Revolutionary era, involved both a public duty and a private right. Our nation is better when we are all pursuing happiness. By focusing on ways to facilitate the pursuit of happiness as an overriding national goal, this could help the center unify the country around a common goal, expressible in a soundbite, instead of further dividing it. Imagine a society, if we ask of every policy, will this harm or help people pursue a good life of the kind our founding fathers had in mind when they created this country? There's no right to happiness. No government can guarantee our happiness. That depends on our own efforts and luck. But government can make it harder or easier to attain happiness. What would a society organized around that understanding look like? Jefferson lived in a very different culture. Most citizens were self-sufficient farmers, craftsmen. The founder's first goal the founder's first goal was protecting their liberty so they could pursue happiness without oppression. But rights were just for white men. But the American system, imperfect and change resistant, eventually allowed women, blacks, minorities, handicapped, and the LGBTQ community to gain liberty and equality under law. Rights essential for the pursuit of happiness, but not enough. That effort continues in a far more interdependent and diverse 21st century society, which new challenges to happiness have arisen. New and creative responses are needed, not just by government, but by organizations, like the one Stan talks about, workplaces, where people spend so much of their time. A meaningful job is essential to the pursuit of happiness. But a recent Gallup poll found that 44% of respondents considered their jobs to be mediocre. Another 16% classified them as bad. Good businesses and government organizations produce products and services that improve the quality of life. They do not harm the environment. But a product of work is also the people who work in these organizations. Eileen Phillipson, psychotherapist in California, writes about patients who look to their workplaces for emotional security, self-esteem, belonging, but they, like many other employees, are stressed, made anxious in jobs with little security, that demand mindless conformity. Gallup surveys report that less than one-third of employees in this country are engaged, fully motivated at work. The majority go through the motions, get paid, and get health care. The best organizations engage employees, develop their abilities and relationships. Leaders encourage innovation, collaboration, respect for individuals and the environment. We need leaders who understand that employees will be engaged when their work has meaningful purpose. Their jobs include continual learning, and they are respected and recognized for their contributions, views, and ideas. From 1972 to 2000, I led programs to humanize work, factories and offices, businesses and government, including AT&T, where Stan pointed out, we re-educated people when jobs changed. Many of these programs benefited from the support of strong unions with leaders who combine cooperation with tough bargaining. The programs gave their members a sense of dignity and security that increased their willingness to share ideas and improve productivity. But the programs disappeared as unions weakened. Managements became free to increase workplace pressures. A major reason for the decline of unions has been national and state laws make it relatively easy to fire union organizers, threaten workers. Strong collaborative unions can provide countervailing power to companies and contribute to the humanization of capitalism. Despite the good intentions of the business roundtable, many companies will not follow its proposal to commit to stakeholder interests instead of making their primary purpose shareholder value. Government regulation is needed to guarantee the health and safety of employees, product safety, environmental protection. Actually, government inspectors are less likely to be concerned about a company's success than cooperative unions that recognize their members benefit from a company that both treats its employees well and is profitable. Finding ways to make work more fulfilling, to put the man before the dollar, in the words of Abraham Lincoln, would be at the top of a 21st century agenda that restored the balance between individual rights and corporate power. Many Americans have benefited from global trade and from the pandemic, while others have lost their jobs. For the losers to be able to pursue their happiness, they need support from the winners, both economic support, training for employment. Retraining can be difficult for industrial workers when the employment opportunities are in service work or technical work that demand very different skills. The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine has stated that the continued advance of information technology implies workers will require skills that increasingly emphasize creativity, adaptability, interpersonal skills over information processing and manual tasks. Studies show that people with a college degree are wealthier and healthier than those without a degree, but there should be productive alternatives to a college education for people who want to enter occupations that require different skills from those taught in colleges, as I mentioned before. I visited an Omaha, Nebraska high school, trained students to be chefs, healthcare aides, bus drivers, truck drivers, plumbers. Apprenticeship programs in factories and building trades can also prepare people for good jobs in this economy. Putting the happiness of ordinary Americans first clearly would involve significant adjustments, health policy, education, even foreign policy, military commitments, might force Congress to reconsider foreign wars that have killed or maimed thousands of young Americans. It's hard to imagine how happiness can be aspired to in 21st century America for people without education. Although they differed on many things, Jefferson and John Adams agreed that education was essential to the pursuit of happiness. Jefferson stated that education without regard to wealth, birth, or other academic accidental condition was necessary for promoting the public happiness. What should be part of that education? Certainly preparation for work life and citizenship. How about a high school course on how to pursue happiness? Anxious and depressed people have a hard time pursuing happiness. Lack of health insurance can be a major source of anxiety. Because of the Affordable Care Act, millions have gained access to health care, but millions are still without this benefit. Gaining quality, affordable health care depends on healthcare organizations and medical practice, not just public policy. Richard mentioned the book that he also co-authored on transforming healthcare leadership that shows a way of improving the quality of healthcare and increasing the number of people in the public who will have health. We have in this country some of the greatest healthcare organizations in the world. I've studied some of them, including Mayo Clinic, Intermountain Healthcare in Salt Lake City, Kaiser Clinic in Pennsylvania. These are learning organizations, continually improve the quality of care, cutting costs, working to improve population health. Other healthcare organizations need to learn from these exemplary models. I mean, this is an issue Stan brought up. How do we get people to learn from the best? How do we get innovations taken on by other groups? This is a major, major challenge. Improving health would also require dealing with a national crisis in mental health, drug abuse, accidental drug overdose, now the leading cause of death for Americans under 50. Anxiety, loneliness, depression, self-injury, and suicide have been on the rise among U.S. teenagers for for almost a decade. A 2017 Atlantic article reported that the Center for Disease Control reports that one third of Americans experience anxiety or depression. That clearly impacts the pursuit of happiness. The causes of debilitating fear and anxiety, social as well as personal, decades of rapid transition from a bureaucratic industrial culture to a culture based on information and knowledge has widened the financial power gap between those able to adapt and those remaining rooted in a vanishing culture. Threats to livelihood and self-esteem have triggered anxiety in people left behind who have been losing industrial jobs due to global competition and automation, and they fear they will never catch up. And they also fear attacks on their beliefs from the left. After Joan C. Williams wrote an article about the fears of the white working class in the Harvard Business Review, a reader wrote her, "Your article deeply articulated the view of my family in a way they never could. They're mostly afraid, afraid of the brown-skinned people, afraid of the day they can't live in their home anymore, afraid of global economics, afraid of those who claim their God is not real, afraid of sexually empowered women, afraid of scientific utterances they don't understand related to climate change, so they just reject it outright. Fear manifests itself in many ways, but it's the same root. The white working class is not the only anxious group. African Americans fear the police as well as community violence, suffer from racism, schooling, housing, employment, and the administration of justice. A Pew study published in February 2019 reported about 70% of US teens report that anxiety and depression are major problems among their peers. Even professionals in the knowledge economy, so-called elite, are not free of anxiety, both at work and socially, constantly being evaluated as employees, social partners. Many feel insecure in their jobs. According to studies by Jean M. Twenge, their children are afraid to grow up in this dangerous world. Twenge also cites reports that increasing numbers of undergraduates suffer overwhelming anxiety rather than focusing on living a purposeful life, pursuing happiness. These young people worry they will become a have-not rather than a have. They worry about paying for education, taking student loans, being saddled with debt. They worried about getting a job that would make their education a good investment. Because living with extreme anxiety can be unbearable, many people repress it. Some escape into entertainment, social media, as well as drugs. Mechanisms of escape become pathological addictions. Some of the people left behind have joined tribalistic political groups that are vulnerable to demagogues, narcissistic leaders who project power and certainty. These leaders stimulate a regressive transference in their followers. They feed the group's narcissism, blame others for their problems, promise magical solutions to the causes of their anxiety. This dynamic threatens all of us, the unity of society, our ability to work together to address threats to our well-being. It was the key factor in the election of Donald Trump, a leader whose narcissistic behavior has increased the fragmentation of our society. Can we address these challenges and work toward a vision of a healthier America where more people can pursue happiness. There's no single policy or policies that will remove the causes of anxiety. There are actions that can engage us in addressing them and in the process turn anxiety into productive energy. We know from psychotherapeutic practice to deal with anxiety without prescribing medication, people first need to wake up to the fears that are feeding the anxiety. Mindfulness meditation can be better than medication, but neither address the causes of anxiety. A challenge for psychotherapists is to help people transform anxiety into productive activity, recognizing there are rational reasons to be afraid. There are real threats to life and well-being today in the environment and with weapons of mass destruction. Can we separate fears that can only be addressed socially and politically from fears that can be overcome by helping people wake up, change their practice of life? To have any chance of doing this, we need to learn more about why so many young people are afraid of relationships and of growing up. We need to learn why some young people are living productive lives and are not escaping from anxiety into psychopathology. Are the parents of the at-risk children transmitting their own fears? Do these children lack models of productive adults? Do the parents lack purpose or meaning other than making themselves marketable products? Do they present a model their children reject? Have fearful members of this generation displaced their unconscious anxiety onto their demands at college for safe spaces, trigger warnings, unwillingness to hear challenging speakers? Why are some people able to live productive lives and pursue happiness, even though they're awakening to the threats we all face in this disruptive and threatening world? A colleague who's a professor at a university writes that while many undergraduates avoid discussions over issues that could cause conflict and news that would increase anxiety, the most productive are awake to some of the causes of anxiety, and they're engaged in trying to deal with them. My experience with some very productive young people, based on reviewing hundreds of questionnaires from young American applicants to become volunteer caregivers in one of the 9 Latin America Caribbean countries served by Nuestros Pequeños Hermanos, our little brothers and sisters with homes, schools, healthcare facilities for orphans and disadvantaged children and their families. The applicants are asked to define the meaning of love, how they practice it. They're asked to describe their purpose in life. Their responses show understanding the difference between sexual and caring love. They describe living purposeful lives with mindsets, continual learning and growth. They have strong ethical and religious values. They want to work with others who share their values and purpose of helping children develop their full potential. They show courage in volunteering to work in challenging cultures and conditions. Can we help children understand what it takes to transcend anxiety and pursue happiness by continual learning and engagement in improving the lives of others? Is anyone happy, really, who doesn't serve others, who doesn't help others? Albert Schweitzer, the great doctor in Africa, wrote that there is no happiness without service. Recent research supports the founders' views of the way to happiness. Derek Bach, former president of Harvard, summarizes a number of studies that conclude, quote, the way to lasting happiness seems to include acts of civic engagement, kindness, other behaviors, far more beneficial to society than an endless pursuit of momentary pleasure, trivial pursuits. In turn, people with high levels of well-being are more likely to be healthy, happily married, effective in their jobs, civic-minded, generous, and tolerant citizens. Abraham Lincoln couldn't have imagined today's 5G world, but he considered the Declaration's wording about happiness to be a key beacon for later generations. Addressing an audience in Lewiston, Illinois, in 1858, he said, quote, when in the distant future, some man, some faction, some interest should set up the doctrine, but none but rich men or none but white men were entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, their posterity might look up again to the Declaration of Independence, take courage to renew the battle which their fathers began. Is it possible to bring the center together to develop policies to facilitate the pursuit of happiness? Groups like the Braver Angels demonstrate that center red and blue citizens can find common policies when they are brought together to share their views. Making the pursuit of happiness a topic for national discussion could help those of us who reject the extremes and shape a new consensus on what our policies for the country should be, could encourage citizens of the center become more active socially and politically to direct local, state, national government to enact policies that facilitate the pursuit of happiness by all Americans. A new banner, pursuit of happiness, could help us view government in a new way. That was true to what the founders.
Thank you.